Good evening and welcome to Tom Harris USA, episode number 23. This episode, I've decided I'm going to go back and revisit a subject that I did part of a show on way, way back in episode number 3. I was talking about researching my family history. Now, some people have come to me and said, wow, that's a really interesting subject. And other people find it a little bit less so. So all I can say is, you know, take it as it comes. Not every episode can be about psychics, right? Or religion or anything else for that matter. So I decided I'm going to just kind of put together a show with just a little bit of information. Because doing genealogy is one of those things that can consume your entire life. It's one of the reasons why a lot of people wait until they're of retirement age to do it. Because it's a time-intensive hobby. Doing research is painstaking, if you're going to do it properly. It takes a lot of energy. And you spend a lot of time in places like archives and libraries. Well, I happen to like spending time in archives and libraries, and I like doing research. It's something that I enjoy. Now, I became very interested in genealogy, perhaps like a lot of people did, inspired in part by the book and the TV series Roots. Roots started a big wave of interest in researching family trees because it told the story of an African named Kunta Kinte who was captured in Africa, sold as a slave, and it was the story of him for the first half and kind of the story of his son and grandson for the rest of the series. Roots is probably not the best example of how to do genealogy. And in fact, many years later, after Alex Haley's death, it was revealed that most of the research that he did was not actually what he wrote about. The book was primarily a work of fiction. There were some historical elements that were real, but he made most of it up. I mean, that's one way, I guess, not to do it. The first place that you would start is talking to your relatives, and in particular, talking to your older relatives. Now, I'm in a situation now where my grandparents' generation on both sides of my family is all gone. I don't have that resource anymore. Now, I've been doing genealogy since about 1979. My grandfather got me started on it. He was interested in it. He didn't have the practical knowledge, and we, of course, didn't have the internet. I think I spoke in episode number 3 a little bit about that, because the internet is both a valuable tool and a very, very dangerous trap. So you really, really have to balance it out. And the more primary sources you use, the better. So let's just kind of differentiate between what a primary source is and what other sources are. A primary source would be something concrete and something legal. So that would be something like a birth certificate, a marriage certificate, a family Bible, or a will. Some sort of legal document or some sort of written document contemporary with the people. Now, they knew what was going on in their lives, and they tended to document these things. If you're lucky, they tended to document them accurately. Because I've seen plenty of instances where documentation has not been so good. But a secondary source would be something put together perhaps by another genealogist. It would be information culled from primary sources. So that would be like a published genealogy or a book about one of your ancestors, if you're lucky enough. That sort of thing. And some secondary sources are actually very useful, but it's always good to be able to go back to a primary research. So basically, where do you start? Well, another very valuable primary source is your own relatives, and in particular, your older relatives. This would be people like aunts, uncles, grandparents, great cousins, and so forth. you would want to go and speak to them. And it's not just enough, perhaps, to, you know, have a casual conversation, because it's very often very easy, especially if you're close to a relative and you have, you know, a wide history of speaking with them, obviously. It's very easy to get sidetracked into things that are unimportant. So I would recommend that if you're going to go speak to an elderly relative, especially, to write down the important questions that you want answered. The other thing that you want to be very careful about is feeling like you're pressuring them. There are going to be times, and I found this myself, when an older relative is not comfortable talking about a subject. You gotta let it go. It'll come. You don't want to just interview grandma or grandpa once. You're going to want to interview them more than once over a period of time. So if you have elderly relatives and you're interested in genealogy and you want to get started, then I would definitely do that. Now, say you're in a situation where, and I was in the situation as well, where a member of the family has published a genealogy of the family. That's actually excellent, because it's something that's very useful, and presumably they've taken appropriate care. Especially if you have, you know, this was a previous generation where they didn't have the internet and people actually had to go to libraries and things to do research. Generally speaking, I found that the scholarship is better than what you're going to find online now. It doesn't mean that it's going to be perfect. There are always going to be some mistakes or omissions, etc. I was very lucky that I had a great aunt who did my mother's side genealogy and did a very thorough job. She was a librarian, though, and a teacher. She knew the value of good research, and we've never found any fault in her research, aside from the occasional typographical error, and the very, very rare. If you're lucky enough to have a published genealogy or research that was done by another relative, you still want to talk to your elderly relatives. Don't let that be a substitute. A, it'll help you by you get to know your older relatives better. And B, it'll give you valuable information that might not be in that book. Now, what I mean by valuable information in this case is things that bring the facts to life. Looking at somebody's family tree is generally not terribly exciting, if it's not yours. What brings the family tree alive are the stories you tell and the things that have happened to the family. Those are things that are best heard firsthand from the people who've experienced them or the people who've been affected by them. So don't dismiss the conversational aspect of your research just because you already have some research that's been done by another family member. So that is your first primary source. Now, that can take years to accomplish. Now, it doesn't mean that's the only thing you're doing during that time. You can also do other things, too, and I'll get to that. But that is your main source, our other family members. Now, sometimes you'll be in a situation where perhaps you're adopted. And then you have to make the choice of whether you consider your adoptive family as your family that you want to research for the purposes of genealogy, or whether you want to pursue your biological roots. Now, that can be somewhat more difficult. I'm not an expert on finding your birth parents. I know that it is possible to do. I have a half-sister who we discovered later in my life who, you know, we've only recently, and I say recently, I mean the last 10 years, have actually gotten to know her. You know, these things do happen. And we have been able to, you know, to talk to her about her, you know, her biological roots. Now, she considers her adoptive parents to be her real family. And as well should be. But we do have a relationship with her now. Anyway, so you have this situation here where you have elderly relatives to talk to. Now, there are other places you can go to do research. So I'm just going to kind of run down some of the places where you can go to do research. One of the most valuable tools for an amateur genealogist who's just getting started out is your public library. Socialism in Action. You can go to the public library and take out books. Now, sometimes genealogy books are not in circulation, meaning you would have to look at them at the library. No matter. But your public library is always a very good place to start because they're going to have books that give you advice on how to do genealogy. Some basic information sometimes. It just kind of depends on how good your library is. I found when I was doing a lot of my research that I was able to accomplish a lot at the local university library. They didn't have a specified genealogy section, but they did have books on genealogical sources in England, which is where most of my research has been done. And they have books, you know, books on Germany doing it, and you know, Jewish genealogy, African American genealogy, and so forth. There are books kind of for everybody, and those are all very good guides on how to get started. But obviously, finding out who your relatives are is your top priority. So you need to talk to your older relatives, find out everything they know about your family's history, where the family came from, why they came to wherever they are. And there's sometimes when your relatives know distressingly little. And I found that myself. Now, my grandfather was not a serious researcher. He kind of poked around. He found a few bits and pieces. You know, there were some things that he knew were so in regards to our lineage. Then there were things that he had heard were so. Now that would be, you know, this would be a tertiary source at best. Hearsay isn't always very accurate. And I have found over the years in the course of my own research that some of the things that he thought were connected with us were not in fact connected with us. It's just a matter, you know, even the best researchers can make mistakes. And that's especially true today in the internet age. And I know I talked about that a little bit in episode number 3. So once you kind of have an idea and you've been able to put together the names, at least names or birthdays or marriage days or where they were from for the last couple of generations back. So your parents and your grandparents and perhaps your great grandparents. Because obviously your grandparents might remember their grandparents. So then you're back another generation to great-great-grandparents. Now, obviously, the number of ancestors you have doubles in each generation. 2 parents, 4 grandparents, 8 great-grandparents, and so on. Filling in each and every slot becomes more difficult as you go further back. So don't expect to fill every slot. Now, those are your dead ends, and those are the things that will keep you occupied. As you do research, you may discover this, and this is certainly the case in my great-grandparents' generation and before. I've definitely found these connections later. I've been very, very lucky in that I knew who all of my great-grandparents were. But that was as far back as we could concretely go. To notate each generation, you have a thing called a pedigree chart. There's many different kinds. They basically will start with one person and go back a few generations. I think normally it's 4 generations back from that person. So they're readily available at genealogy libraries, or you can just kind of draw them yourself. You can look online. There's also genealogy software that can help you create your family charts and so forth. So the pedigree chart actually shows you one person and that person's ancestors back for several generations. The other type of chart you're going to find yourself using a lot is a family group chart. And that would be chart that lists a husband and a wife and all of their children. And this is just, you need both of them, obviously. It is one of the more tedious aspects of filling out family group charts. But it is also very, very important that you do so, because that is where you're going to find interesting connections to other families, is in the children that perhaps you weren't paying much attention to. So there's a number of other places that you can go, and these are still considered primary sources. If you know where they're living, you can go to census records. Now, in the U.S., we have censuses done every 10 years. And these censuses exist every 10 years back to 1850, except for 1890. And the reason why the 1890 census we don't have is because all except for a very few counties, mostly in the South, the records were destroyed in a fire. So that is not a tool that genealogists have anymore. It's very frustrating for genealogists, that 1890 barrier. And it's one that's caused me a great deal of frustration, but I seem to have gotten past it now, and I don't have to worry too much about it. Now, there's a couple different things that you do with a census record. It's very useful because if you know where your family lived, there are indexes. Now, the indexes really don't go much beyond 1880. You can look up from the 1930 census, which is the most recent census that has been released to the general public. They are not releasing the censuses because, as most of the people who were alive then die off, they don't want to reveal too much information about living people. I think that's the primary thing. And in 1930, most of the people who were alive in 1930 are now gone. So the next one to be released will be 1940. Not sure when. But if you know where your folks were living in 1930, you can go to the census records, each one of your ancestors, and look it up. Now, a number of things that you'll find in the census records are very useful. If you are able to find your ancestor, and if you have a street address, you're golden, because they arrange the census by neighborhood and by street. If you don't, then there are things like indexes and soundexes that can help you to locate the right place in the census to look. So, in the case of a 1930 census, it's going to tell you the name and address of everybody living at that address. So, typically, if you're looking for a nuclear family group, you're going to have the father, his age, his occupation, where his parents were from, and the same for the mother. And then you would have all of the children who are living in the household and their ages, and if they're old enough, their occupations. So that's an incredibly useful thing, and you can find surprises there. But it also gives you clues, because you can see that your grandfather's father came from Germany, or your grandmother was a seamstress. These are things that, knowing their occupation is one of those things that I kind of think of as a color thing. It's a fact that is interesting. Now, I happen to have a great-grandfather who was a upholsterer, and he did some tailoring and that sort of thing as well. But mainly he did things like draperies and upholstery. And so that was, something that I didn't know before. You can tell these things. I had another great-grandfather who was a streetcar driver. So, these are things that are interesting and isn't something that necessarily you're going to hear from the older relatives unless you think to ask them. What did great-grandpa do for a living? Do you remember? These are all quite good questions to ask. The other thing that you're going to find, the family groupings are together. Now, quite often, different members of a family would settle near the same place. If they're in a rural area, it might be the farm next door or two doors down. they would tend to stay sort of in the same area. Really, the era where people have really started to move around has been the last 50 years, where you have people moving across the country. Prior to that, people generally would stay within, 50 miles of where they were. So that's something to keep in mind. Now, that's not always the case, because obviously we're not native to this continent. Now, I speak, here mainly of American roots. You're trying to trace people who are from America. We'll get into the more foreign information shortly. So you're able, through the census, to figure out, Grandpa was born in New York, but his father was born in Connecticut. See? And then you can go back again, and I would highly recommend going back every 10-year census and seeing, if you can find them, and seeing where they were living at that point. And again, the censuses have indexes and soundexes that you can use. Now, most of these things are going to be stored on microfilm. And there are a number of places where you can find this information online. Now, sometimes they'll want you to pay a fee for it. But you can usually access this information in libraries for free. Now, I'm not going to plug a particular religion here. But if you're a genealogist, and especially if you're an amateur genealogist, one of the places that is going to be most useful for you to go is a Latter-day Saints genealogy library. These are libraries that are set up especially, for genealogy research by the Mormons. You don't need to be a Mormon to use them. Sometimes they charge you a nominal fee of a couple of dollars, and sometimes they don't. It just kind of depends. The research facilities are generally pretty good. However, you need to be careful. And we'll get into that in a sec. Now, the Mormons have compiled this thing called the International Genealogical Index, or IGI. And the IGI is a record that it was made by members of the Mormon Church going around to town halls and vital statistics bureaus and things all across the United States and all across Europe and some other countries as well. Now, they would copy down parish records and baptism records and so forth, all for the purpose of baptizing these dead people into the Mormon religion. That's what they do. I just kind of ignore that because I don't, even though I know that I'm descended from a lot of people who were baptized in the Mormon Church, they have no idea that they were Mormons. They were long dead by the time they were baptized as Mormons. So the thing you had to watch out for when you're dealing with the Mormon research centers is that they have a pretty good selection of secondary sources. These are things like the IGI. When you're looking up ancestors' names in the IGI, trying to locate them, if you know, for example, you're looking at the IGI for New York and you're looking for John White, and there's 13 John Whites listed in that town. Obviously, they're not all related to each other. They're not all the same person. So you have to be very careful that you have the right one. And the only way to do that is through research, through more research. You can look for a John White who was born around the right time or on the right date in the right place. But that doesn't guarantee that it's going to be a correct match. There are a lot of errors that are made, and it's probably the biggest error that I see people making in genealogy, and it's one I've made myself. So I know it's insidious. Even if you're very careful, it still can crop up, and that is a names the same mistake. And especially if you have a common last name, like Brown or White or Cooper or Smith, or you can very, very easily go astray. And you don't want to be too cautious And at the same time, you don't want to be too lax. One thing I would definitely avoid when you're starting out are the Mormon family history files. And the reason why I generally recommend that people avoid those, especially when they're starting out, is that there's a lot of bad research in those files. The Mormons believe that that you can save your ancestors retroactively by baptizing them. So there's definitely a incentive for them to find as many ancestors as possible so that they can be baptized into the Mormon Church. The problem with that is that they often have very sloppy research, and they make a lot of names the same mistakes. So I do kind of warn people away from the Mormon family history files. I would guess that perhaps 40% of them are accurate, which isn't that impressive. But generally, especially for local history, the Mormon libraries are a very useful tool. And what you'll find is as you go further back, you can find more specialized books. And eventually you'll get into a point, if you can go far enough back in the U.S., where you have a lot of secondary source material. This would be things like passenger lists. Actually, passenger lists would be a primary source. But things like published genealogies. If you can connect yourself to a family that's been well-researched in the past, then you're golden, because you'll have an immediate wealth of information. There, for example, I haven't done any research much, you know, really on the Hickok family or the Holcomb family. Both are families that I'm connected to. And both of them have been extensively researched, and definitive books on those families have already been published, mostly in the 1930s and 40s, and you know, back before the internet period. The internet can be a very good place to do research, but you also have to be very, very careful. Again, the name's the same mistake. You need to know what their sources are in order to get an accurate thing. You know, it's you don't want to spend years researching the wrong family. That's how I look at it. You want to be absolutely sure, or at least within, you know, a reasonable doubt, that the family you're researching is actually your family. And once you have made that determination within a reasonable doubt, then I proceed. But I did spend, you know, many years researching a wrong family just because I read it. I trusted a secondary source that wasn't very good. So it pays to be careful. So when you get to a point of getting overseas, then it becomes a little bit more difficult. Now, you can do research from America using overseas sources. The Mormons have some of them. You know, some of the countries, there are books about passengers coming from a certain part of the world, German genealogy and so forth. But generally speaking, the more of the native language you speak, the better, because a lot of your sources for Germany are going to be in German, or Italy, they're going to be in Italian. It's always better to be able to do the research overseas. However, that isn't always going to happen. Quite often, you can get good information from a family society or a family group or family club. For example, the Harris Family Society, or the D'Alessandro Family Society, or the Noritake Family Society. You know, there are groups for, you know, for researchers who are doing particular family names. It doesn't mean that they're all related. It just means that they're, you know, but there's always the possibility of connecting with distant cousins who are working on the same family as you. Well, this half hour has flown by. I guess I'm going to have to come back to the subject at a future time. If people have any questions, I think it would be useful if you would ask them, and then I can address particular issues individually. I really hope that this has been useful to some people who might be thinking about doing their own family research. It certainly is a very rewarding hobby. And trust me when I say if you take the trouble to do the research and do it right, your family will be grateful. I've always kind of had this weird notion here, and I guess it's not terribly uncommon. Look, I am primarily gay. It's very doubtful that I'm ever going to have any kids. So I'm not contributing to the future generations of this family. It's the very least I can do, in my opinion, to help contribute to the family's past. Is that the good role for a gay member of the family? Yeah, well, I think it is. Anyway, like I said, if you have questions, feel free to contact me. My email address is tom@tomharrisusa.com. I'm not giving out the old address anymore. The old address still works if you're listening to one of the older shows, but and I do check it every day, but I do want the mail to start coming into the primary email address for the show. So anyway, hope you've enjoyed this episode. I will come back to this, I promise, or I'm threatening to come back to this subject if you don't enjoy the show. So from Tom Harris here at Tom Harris USA, I'm signing off for now. I'll see you next time.